I would also like to ask a couple of questions, just in the interest of bringing out some of the details about the proposal that we're considering. First, as you've certainly pointed out, Rule 3526A would require the auditor to disclose all relationships with the potential client before accepting the engagement that may reasonably be thought to bear on independence. How far back in time would the auditor have to look in doing that? Do they have to report all past relationships back to the beginning of time that they may have had with the company or its financial reporting executive?
Well, the proposed rule uses a principles-based approach by not specifying the particular time period and instead would require the accounting firm to disclose all relationships they may reasonably thought to bear on independence during the audit period and then possibly during earlier periods. In determining what relationships may reasonably be thought to bear on independence, the accounting firm would need to consider, in addition to whether the firm provided any prohibited services or maintained any prohibited relationships, the perception of reasonable investor. The accounting firm would need to consider all relationships that they have had with the issuer, even if those relationships occurred several years ago, and focus on the perceptions of reasonable third parties when making the determination regarding whether the specific relationship may reasonably be thought to bear on independence. I would like to note that the passage of time is a relevant consideration when the accounting firm is making this determination. And then we are also seeking specific comments on whether the initial communication required by Rule 3526A should be limited to a particular time period, and welcome commenters' views on this specific topic.
Okay, so even without a specific time period, we recognize that eventually the impact on independence could, I suppose, would become attenuated and might not be a reasonable perception any longer.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'll take that answer then. How does it relate to the second part of the rule, the requirement to annually inform the audit committee about the same relationships? In other words, does the auditor have to keep telling the committee over and over again the things that it's previously reported since there isn't any firm time deadline?
Well, let me take that one, Bella. Certainly with regard to relationships that have been previously communicated and relationships that no longer exist, I think the auditor would have satisfied their obligation to communicate those things in that earlier period. And with regard to those relationships that no longer exist, the staff wouldn't expect that the auditor would have to communicate those in a subsequent period. I think with regard to relationships that currently exist in that current period, I think that those are qualify for consideration as to whether the auditor would need to communicate those to the audit committee at that time.
So I guess the short answer is maybe, or in some cases information would have to be reported.
Potentially, there would be the way the rule is constructed.
Okay, let me turn to something else. I think you alluded to the IPO situation, Bella, in your comments, and one thing this proposal would do is add a note to Rule 3523 that would say that in the IPO context, the provision of tax services before the earlier of the date that the firm either signed the engagement letter to perform the audit under PCAOB procedures or began to perform those procedures doesn't impair the independence of the accounting firm under Rule 3523. What's the relationship between that note and Rule 3526? In other words, if Rule 3523 says these pre-IPO tax services don't impair independence, could they reasonably be seen as bearing on independence and have to be disclosed to the audit committee? Or can you just put those aside?
Well, I think in the specific context that you are describing, those relationships may need to be disclosed to the audit committee if the accounting firm would conclude that a reasonable investor would consider that such services may be reasonably thought to bear on the firm's independence. Although the staff is recommending that the board propose to allow the accounting firm to provide tax services to the company's executives before the professional engagement period commences, the accounting firm would still remain responsible for considering all the relevant facts and circumstances of the specific tax engagement in light of the SEC's general standard and the reasonable investor. Finally, the requirement in Rule 3526 is not meant to be an exclusive requirement to only require the accounting firm to communicate only those relationships that impair independence. The requirement, similar to the current requirement in ISB 1, is meant to be principles-based and encompass those relationships that may reasonably be thought to bear on independence, even though it might appear in relation to a particular rule that the relationship did not impair the firm's independence. So the answer is maybe. It depends on the specific facts and circumstances.
Oh, I wasn't going to use maybe as the summary for that one. I thought the answer there was the note to 3523 really doesn't bear on 3526. You've still got to perform the same analysis under Rule 3526 as to whether the prior
The analysis would still have to be performed, correct, in terms of if the relationship would have to be definitely reported to the audit committee as something that may bear on the firm's independence. That's where the maybe comes in.
just before we leave that topic altogether, maybe we could comment generally about what's supposed to happen in the IPO situation. As if you envision a firm, a private company, and a firm that's been its auditor for many years, and during those many years performing both audit and non-audit services for the company that would be prohibited under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. The private company now decides to go public. Obviously, the accounting firm has to stop performing those prohibited services. Do they have to tell the audit committee about, or the board, if there isn't one, what they presumably know already? In other words, what the firm has been doing for the company over the last
however many years?
Yeah.
Well, even if the accounting firm provided permissible non-audit services under the AICPA independence rules that are prohibited under the SEC or the PCAOB independence rules, the auditor would still need to consider all those services and relationships to make a determination if they believe that it may reasonably be thought to bear an independence and therefore to communicate them to the audit committee. It, again, goes back to the requirement of where it is relationships that may reasonably be thought to bear an independence, not relationships that have impaired independence under the SEC or PCAOB rules, and therefore the auditor would have to consider all those relationships and determine which ones they would need to communicate.
So even this sort of ongoing relationship, that when there's a transformation from private to public, there's presumably going to have to be some point at which the auditor is going to have to put this information together and present it to the board or audit. Let me turn to a somewhat mysterious part of all this that again, you alluded to in your comments, and that is the issue of secondary auditors. As I understand the proposal, the auditor would have to inform the committee about any relationships that it has with the client or its financial reporting executives, or any relationships that its affiliates might have. But if it's also relying on the work of unaffiliated firms for some aspect of the audit, then the registered firm or the primary auditor doesn't have, as I understand it, any communications responsibilities with respect to whether those firms, those secondary firms, are independent. Who does? I mean, did they just fall through the system? I assume they have to be independent if they're participating in a PCOB-based SEC filed.
Well, as the secondary auditor has the same responsibility as the primary auditor to be independent as it relates to a particular audit client. Just because they're a secondary auditor doesn't mean their independence requirements are secondary versus primary. Also, the primary auditor has a responsibility under AU 543 to obtain a representation from the other auditor that he or she is independent as it relates to a particular audit engagement. Of course, the issuer itself has the ultimate responsibility to obtain an independent audit. The proposed rule, however, as you stated, does not require the primary auditor to consider or disclose to the audit committee all relationships of unaffiliated secondary auditors that may be reasonably thought to bear on independence of the secondary auditor. In this respect, the proposal is similar to ISB 1, and the staff believes that there may be practical reasons not to require such disclosures. The proposing release does seek additional comments about whether any additional information should be communicated under the rule, and the staff welcomes any input on the feasibility and appropriateness of extending the rule to non-affiliated secondary auditors.
Just to go back to something you said in the middle, but while we may not have passed the information along to the audit committee, the primary auditor does have an obligation to get a representation from a secondary firm that it's independent under U.S. independence rules. I take it what we're primarily talking about here are foreign firms that may be operating in countries that have, you know, different conceptions of independence. But we'll assume U.S. primary auditor has to satisfy itself that those
right.
firms are.
Right. The primary auditor does have a responsibility to satisfy themselves that the secondary auditors that are participating in the engagement are independent, and they are required to obtain a representation from those secondary auditors.
Just one last thing. I mean, it's so surprising to me, at least, that under the setup today, the audit committee wouldn't have to learn about independence issues until essentially, you know, the end of the audit, after it was maybe, you know, way too late to do anything about them. Do we have any information, empirical, anecdotal, from anywhere about what actually happens in practice? I would think that in practice, audit committees would be asking to get this information before they retain a firm rather than down the road.
I think, Dan, what you were referring to is what period in time currently does the ISB 1 communication happen between the auditor and the audit committee? Is it at the beginning of the engagement, middle of the engagement, toward the end of the engagement? Does it vary? It is our understanding from all the information we have is that the ISB 1 communication typically happens at the end of the audit engagement when the company issues the financial statements. Part of that is, I think, because of what practice has become. And also, one interesting thing to note is, as stated in the background and basis for conclusions when the Independent Standards Board issued ISB 1, they actually considered whether to require the discussion between the audit committee and the auditor to take place before substantial auditing procedures commenced. And they chose not to do that because of practical requirements. I think in this point in time, because of the passage of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and the current requirement of the audit committee to actually appoint an independent auditor, I think it is appropriate at this time to have a requirement to have that communication occur before the initial engagement is commenced pursuant to the standards of the PCOB, and then annually thereafter, assuming that it would occur from the beginning on an annual basis.
Okay, well, thanks for all that. As I said earlier, I've had some reservations about all the time and effort that's gone into this project, but I do appreciate the work that you guys have done on it. I think all that time and effort now has actually led to something that'll have a positive effect on the work of audit committees. Thank you.
John? Well, thank you, Tom, Bella, Greg. Thank you for your excellent work and diligence, and congratulations on continued standard setting in post-AS5 era.
Thank you.
I do support the proposal to modify our rule related to tax services provided by audit firms to individuals employed by audit clients. As I said when the board issued the concept release, the way perceived impairments to independence have historically been addressed is to add rules to cover our new situations that arise. But as the list of per se independence impairments have grown, so have the difficulties in finding auditors without conflicts. At times, conflicts have been resolved with individualized exceptions and exemptions, but this is not a solution that I favor. Such a process is not transparent or accessible to investors, and thus in fixing a conflict, it may be, nevertheless, further erode investor confidence that the rules protect auditor independence. Therefore, to avoid exacerbating the problem of increasing conflicts, I think we need to be careful to make sure our rules are no broader than necessary. Tax services provided to managers involved in financial reporting during the audit present significant independence concerns. But at this stage in our process, I am not convinced that those issues extend to the period before a firm commences a PCOB audit and begins interaction with management for purposes of conducting the audit. Limiting the rule to cover only the professional engagement period would help to ensure our rules are broader than necessary. I'd like to make one other point regarding our request for comment. The proposal describes how Rule 3523, as amended, would apply to registered firms that provided tax services to management prior to an IPO. That is, the rule would not prevent a firm from becoming the auditor of record for the IPO, even if prior to the IPO, the firm had performed tax services for individual managers. A number of commenters on our concept release asked the board to consider providing a transition exemption or exception so that the firms could continue to provide personal tax services for the first 180 days of the audit engagement. I find this comment a bit confusing. The transition period sought is long and indeed could extend past the completion of the first PCAOB audit. That doesn't strike me as good policy, and unfortunately, none of the comments in favor of such an exception provided any analysis of showing that the exception would not have a detrimental effect on the auditor independence, or even if it did, that the risk to the auditor independence could be justified by a competing policy goal to maximize the pool of firms available to accept the audit engagement. We'll be asking for additional comment on this point. To the extent commenters continue to seek such an exception, I hope they will provide a deeper analysis. Finally, I support proposing to require auditors to have a dialogue with the audit committee about independence before they take on a new engagement. One of the reasons I favor keeping per se independence rules as narrow as necessary is that I put a lot of stock in the SEC's general requirement that companies and auditors avoid circumstances that would lead a reasonable investor to conclude that the auditor is not capable of exercising objective and impartial judgment. For this general requirement to work, though, I think it requires careful thought by auditors and audit committees as the first line of defense. The proposed new rule is designed to give audit committees the information they need to make this assessment and to encourage dialogue at an earlier stage than it necessarily takes place in every case today. I look forward to the public comment. Thank you.
Kayla?
Thank you. I want to thank staff for your time and effort on this as well. I think I would like to most align myself with the comments of Mr. Gelzer. I mean, as the staff well knows, I've had some serious reservations about the first part of this proposal. Although I support it going out for comment, I continue to have reservations about whether or not carving out this small, narrow exception really does impact the perception of independence. We heard from 13 commenters, all of whom have a self, or 12 of whom have a self-interest in that independence decision, and only one of whom, an investor, was providing us with that perception of the reasonable investor or the reasonable third party. And so I'm hoping that we can get more comment during this as we have an actual amendment to comment upon. If we don't get too many comments from investors, that probably tells us something as well, and I recognize that. So I am interested in the public comment. I am, though, enthusiastically in supporting the release of the proposed amendments to the ethics rules for the amendments to what have formerly been called ISV 1. I think that this, if again, as Dan mentioned, all of the angst that we've gone through to get here on 3523, if it's produced proposed 3526, I think it will have been well worth it. And I thank you for your patience and tolerance as we've gone through the process. I did want to probe a little bit on a question that Dan asked. He was talking about needing to, once an auditor has disclosed certain conflicts, whether there need to be continuous redisclosure of the same facts. I wanted to point out that membership on audit committees are not fixed and that they turn over and change, not only once a company is public from year to year, but certainly going from private to public, there's a lot of turnover and changes on audit committees. And I just would like you to comment on and the need to continue to make sure that the current audit committee members are fully apprised of all potential items that might be thought to bear on independence.
Sure. I'd try to elaborate on that. As I said earlier, I think the staff in applying the rule would say that previous relationships that had been disclosed that no longer exist wouldn't need to be disclosed to the audit committee today, but that all current relationships should be evaluated and that indeed they ought to be considered for disclosure to the audit committee.
Not sure if you've addressed my point. Maybe we can talk about it further. Anyway, thank you very much.
Bill Gradson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, want to thank the staff that have worked so hard on this proposal, and I support everything you're recommending. I do have a question about Rule 3526. It is quite properly based upon professional judgment, that is, a judgment of the auditor as whether independence may reasonably be thought to be impaired. We live in a very litigious society, and that kind of a professional judgment can be subject to second-guessing. Is there anything in the proposal with regard to 3526 that would cause the, which would limit the auditor to reporting to the audit committee in writing those things which in the auditor's judgment are unreasonable, as well as those that are reasonable as a protection? In other words, is there anything to in this proposal which focuses on things that are unreasonable, that are that may reasonably be thought, is there anything by saying it that way that would stop the auditor from protecting themselves by just throwing everything out there, even things which in their judgment, their professional judgment, could not be are relationships, but could not be considered to impair independence?
Well, I think the rule is designed to require the auditor to communicate those matters that may reasonably be thought to bear on the auditor's independence. So that is what the rule is intended to do. There is nothing in the rule, as far as I'm concerned, that would prevent the auditor from communicating additional information to the audit committee, either for the purpose of more fully informing the audit committee about what relationships exist or for other purposes. I might just turn to general counsel if they might like to elaborate on that point.
No, I think that's right. The rule sets a floor, and firms can go beyond it if they wish to do so. I would say the rule also requires the registered firm to have a discussion then with the audit committee about the potential effects on its independence of the relationships disclosed, so the firm probably would need to elaborate on the differences between the relationships if it were going to disclose, as in your example, every relationship it's had. Obviously, the point of the rule is to foster a robust, meaningful discussion between the firm and the audit client. But again, the rule set the floor, and accounting firms could decide to disclose more relationships than are required.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll put the question to the board. All those in favor of approving the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it. The motion is carried. Congratulations. If there's no further business, this concludes our agenda today, and the meeting is now adjourned. So we will rise from the open meeting and then reconvene a closed board meeting in 10 minutes.